Recent financial crisis in Kazakhstan, particularly involving devaluation of Kazakh currency, tenge, and similar trends in national currencies of several other Central Asian countries are seen directly connected to what's happening in China. Although since then things are getting a little bit normal, but it has shown vulnerability of Central Asian economy to anything that happens in its immediate neighbor. In this case, being one of the major trade partner, financial health of China has a direct effect to the entire region. Today, we aim to discuss health of Central Asian economy, elements triggering the recent regional financial difficulties, including the decline of Russian economy and price of oil. We will also look into what might follow next. Hello, welcome to the Majlis. I am Mohammed Tahir, Director of Turkmen Service at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and host of the show. To discuss the subject, joining me from Glasgow is Dr. Luka Ancici, Director of Central Asian Studies Center at the University of Glasgow. Paolo Servillo, Deputy Editor of the Convoy Bulletin and expert on Central Asian economy, and Bruce Panier, Editor of Kishlak Awazi, a Central Asia blog at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Welcome, gentlemen, to the show.
Thank you.
Hi. Thank you.
Now, let's start with you, Paolo. What's the connection between what is happening in Chinese and Central Asian economy, particularly in your area of expertise in Kazakhstan and obviously region at large?
Well, the issue is that China has experienced an internal economic decision to tackle its currency and the exchange rate with the dollar. And that's for internal purposes. But China is also the major importer of commodities. And commodities prices are very low at the moment due to the strength of the dollar and the lower prices. And on the other hand, we see Central Asia, in particular Kazakhstan, which are mostly commodity exporters. And this has had a very strong impact on Kazakhstan in particular, and that triggered the sharp devaluation of last week. But this, the devaluation in Kazakhstan is a little bit delinked from the Chinese crisis because of the nature of the devaluation was very sharp, and it was triggered mostly by the fact that the tenge was already overvalued, especially against the ruble. And so the whole regional economic situation had a big impact on the decision to devalue the tenge sharply, and also the low commodities prices as well.
The way I understand, Paolo, from your comments, that devaluation of yuan, the Chinese currency, did not directly influence the devaluation of Kazakh tenge. Did I understand you correctly?
Yes, and if I may add something, they also said this, the Kazakh government said that after the yuan devaluation, when they said that it was a lucky strike that they had devalued right before the yuan. And so, I think we could dispute this statement very easily, but I think it's not directly related.
It's not exactly related, Dr. Luka. How do you see the connection between these two economies? What's happening there?
Well, there are two sides of the situation here. On the one hand, you have, and I mostly speak about Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan, you have economies that have not reformed the last 25 years, that they pretty much have exactly the same structure of production that they used to have when the Soviets were in place, so are strong degree of dependency on oil, gas, and of course of prices for these commodities actually show that when the commodities rise go low, it's going to be a disaster. And then of course it goes out of the real economy, it becomes a financial issue. So this is the main sort of, if you want, the backdrop. The other side of the things is that when you are already under the pressure of dependency on energy resources, you also become dependent on your customers, whoever buys your own resources. So the main customers for Kazakhstan and for Turkmenistan are actually Russia and China, which are not exactly two economies that are doing really well at the moment, especially the Russia has been troubled in the last 12 months. China, we're talking about a lower growth, which for that kind of economic magnitude is a problem. It's very relevant. So that kind of situation of dependency on one, two customers, which in case of Turkmenistan is actually 100% almost on China at the moment, it shows that it can become a period of trouble when these customers are actually going through some economic problems. What I find most interesting about all of this is that, especially Kazakhstan, the regime has been using the rhetoric that we have a very globalized economy, so the downturn at global level inevitably hits us. But what they're trying to sort of mask is the fact that their economic development model has substantially failed. And now they got to the point at which their extreme dependency on resources is no longer sustainable, because the oil is trading between $40 and $50 per barrel. And that's something which Kazakhstan simply cannot afford. So I think that what we're seeing is a specific moment of very complex economic trouble for the economic authoritarian middle of Central Asia.
My question is kind of connected, Dr. Luca and Paolo, both of you were saying, like, the trigger behind recent trouble in Kazakhstan, the devaluation of money in rest of at least some of the Central Asian countries, are because the price of commodities are decreased. In this case, I'm just looking at the chart that I have, I brought here with me, that when we talk about the commodity, China stands as the main export partner of Kazakhstan, with 21% of exports going to China from Kazakhstan among the total number that they export every year. It's like 59% of those commodities going to China is the oil from Kazakhstan. So although it seems like tenge is kind of stable today, but the price of oil is declining. So what we should expect, what we should look for seeing in the days to come then?
Yeah, look, I don't have a particular positive outlook for the economy for the region at this stage, mostly because we probably entered a protracted period of low commodity prices, and this economic decision makers have simply have not changed the structure of production. In Kazakhstan, substantive part of the government revenues come from the oil price and from the oil, the same in Turkmenistan, in fact, even more in Turkmenistan, a percentage. And what we see here is the fact that now these people are selling the same resources half the price they were selling 12 months ago.
Yeah.
So since there are many experts who agree that we enter at a time in which oil prices are staying low, this is not a good prospect. And if I just made a final thing, with the decline of the oil prices, the system of corruption, subsidies, economic patrimonialism that Central Asia has established and developed in 25 years is going to an end, which is a problematic issue for the leaders.
Wow. I'm just looking at the figures that I have about the trade turnover between China and Turkmenistan. In Turkmenistan, China is the absolute major trade partner, as you said, with mind-blowing 68% of share in its total export going to China. And second to China for Turkmenistan is Turkey, with only 5% of its share. My question is, Bruce, you might also jump in here. What is the indication that the situation is creating troubles in economy of those countries which are exporting commodities to China, like oil, like gas, like or any other sort of energies, which directly falls into this basics of this crisis?
Well, you know, I mean, we're just kind of getting into it. It's only been a few months they've really had to deal with it. You know, Kazakhstan, of course, is a great example where as of last week, they were already making plans to revise their budget, and that's the third time they've had to revise their budget in less than a year. This is a big problem for the governments in trying to figure out how they're going to allocate what funds they have, because they're trying to hit a shooting target here. Their funds are going down, and they're trying to figure out now what are the priority projects that they just absolutely have to have, and what aren't so important. what is not so important that it can be dispensed with. Now, in the case of Tajikistan, for instance, today, Emomali Rahman, the president, had promised that there was going to be wage increases, pension increases, across the board. And today he came out and said that's not going to happen, because these are the... Because of the current economic situation, that's all off the table now. Everyone's canceling projects that suddenly they realize would have to be considered extravagant given the current financial situations that they're all dealing with. And as I mentioned, we're only a couple months into this. Lucas said that this is going to last for several years now. Kazakhstan, to give you another example of what's going to happen with them, Kashagan, of course, and I know Luca and Paolo know this very well. Kashagan is figured that it can only be profitable if oil is $80 or $90 a barrel. Well, that's not going to happen for a very, very long time, because with the improvements they've made in shale gas and shale oil production, shale oil is profitable if the price of oil is about somewhere $50, $60 a barrel. Now, that guarantees that the minute oil hits $50 or $60 a barrel, this shale oil companies are all going to kick into business again. So the chances that oil is going to hit $80 or $90 anytime in really the next 10 years are very, very low. It's a huge problem, especially, I don't want to pick on Kazakhstan, but Kazakhstan has kind of grown accustomed, and its people have grown accustomed to this wealth, this affluence that, everyone thought it's the typical El Dorado story. It's never going to end, and you can just spend and spend. And this is going to be real hard on the people. They're only just now starting to feel what this really means. A few months, couple years down the road at the most, there's going to be a totally different economic situation, not just in Kazakhstan, but all across Central Asia. A lot of these promises the governments have been making and saying are carved in stone, they're absolute, we're going to do them, are all going to be taken off the table and withdrawn. And how the people are going to react to this is going to be a huge question for the governments in the region.
Interesting. The same things were happening in Turkmenistan. Paolo, I will come back to you in a second. Only this year, Turkmenistan is working on 3-4 major projects. One is the sports complex, which will host indoor Asian Olympics Games, which is worth to some $6 billion or $5 billion. And at the same time, a construction of a major port is going on in Turkmenbashi. And it seems to me that Turkmenistan was either not aware of what's coming up, or it felt that it's ready to undertake this project in any price. So do you think the Chinese, also the Central Asians, were not expecting this crisis in China, Paolo?
Well, yeah. I mean, especially the Central Asians were not expecting a crisis, really. Especially as Bruce said, after all the projects were planned, the Norli Jol in November 2014, and all the new projects in Kazakhstan away from the energy sector. And to go back to Luca's point about the high dependency on commodity exports, I think there is a wider question here, because in Kazakhstan they started talking after the devaluation. They started talking about austerity, and one may ask if austerity is the right policy with such a high dependency. If you don't change the structure of your economy, austerity seems to be a weak patch for your problems.
Sure.
Can I add something? I don't think that they didn't expect the crisis. I think that us, as Central Asia watchers, have somehow missed or sort of underestimated a couple of instances. One is what Paolo just mentioned, the fact that in between the last 6 months of 2014 and the first 6 months of this year, Kazakhstan was issuing sort of mixed declaration. One was about austerity and one was about growth, which indicated they didn't know what to do, but they somehow perceived that something was coming, and the election really was sort of anticipated and brought forward for 1 year, because they knew that they had to devalue, and they wanted to do that when Nazarbayev had a longer time. But I think that we even misunderstood more what was the importance, the significance of Turkmenistan's decision to suspend the system of subsidies, which occurred earlier on in 2015. That, however smallish the Turkmen economy might actually be, that was a symbolic decision, which the government somehow acknowledged the fact that we are no longer in a position to sustain this kind of patrimonialism that we have. So all our dreams of being the Kuwait of Central Asia are simply vanishing with our decision to make people pay for gas and pay for electricity. Also, Turkmenistan in the last 6 months, I detected, you know, when you say Turkmen foreign policy, it's very much about the declarations more than what the operational things, side of things are. So I did see Bedi Muhammadov going abroad and trying to portray the image of Turkmenistan as a diversifying economy. And, you know, and I, you know, we saw in the last couple of weeks when he tried to sell electricity to Kyrgyzstan in one of your podcasts, John Roberts, I think, mentioned that Turkmenistan was trying to become a petrochemical giant in Central Asia. Mm. But also with, you know, engaging both Bulgaria and Pakistan for two different pipelines, it shows to me that even they have realized that there is something which is profoundly wrong with their model, but simply don't know how to react. So obviously, the perception of what went on was different across the region, but in these two specific energy-rich countries, there was sort of awareness that things weren't going great, but the measures to respond to that were simply disorganized.
Here I want to take a little break. When we come back, I will start a discussion with some interesting comparison between Russian and Chinese rule in Central Asian economy. To give little hint, the devaluation of ruble was far worse than recent Chinese yuan. But the impact of ruble crisis hasn't been as dramatic as devaluation of Chinese currency. How to read this contrast? Let's talk after the break. Welcome back to the Majlis. I am Mohammed Tahir, host of the show. With me in the studio is Bruce Panier, editor of Central Asia blog at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, called Kishlak Awazi. Paolo Sobrillo, editor of the Convoy Bulletin. We know Paolo with his unique expertise on economy of Central Asia. And Dr. Luca Ancisci, director of Central Asian Studies Center at the University of Glasgow, is with us. So, Dr. Luca, it is a little political and little economic question. As I said earlier, the Russian economy is also in turmoil for some time now, mostly because of sanctions in, you know, falling ruble's value, declining oil price, as we just spoke in the first half of the show. And the devaluation of ruble has been unprecedented when you compare it with the Chinese move. But shockwaves of yuan has been far stronger compared to the ruble, yet we know Central Asia is a backyard of Russia. How to understand this?
Well, I think that this is probably the worst possible scenario for Central Asia, because last year we had the crisis of the ruble, which impacted, of course, Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan, but more so Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, and Tajikistan, who actually have a big number of migrants in Russia. So financial crisis in Russia, monetary crisis in Russia, in turn hit the real economy back home, because those migrants were not sending back the same amount of remittances that they used to. Whereas this year, the crisis hit the big purchaser of commodities. So now the other side of Central Asia, those countries who do not have that many migrants abroad, are suffering. So really, I would not consider the two as being one worse than the other, even because, unfortunately for Central Asia, these two crises are happening at the same time. The Russian crisis is developing even now, as we speak, you know, with the ruble. So it's not that one actually happened with the other. But I think that the China situation is also, well, at the moment it's purely financial. But in 5-6 months' time, that will hit very hard the real economy in Central Asia. A lot of investment, a lot of product, a lot of construction is actually done by China within Central Asia. I mean, Alex Cooley forged, you know, the beautiful expression that China is a provider of public goods for these regimes. Well, I'm sort of thinking that that kind of role, should the Chinese crisis continue, would have to be revised by decision makers in Beijing. So on the one hand, you have an economy that's slow, that grows at a slower rate, so it requires less fuel resources. On the other hand, you have less capital to invest, and you don't invest as much in Central Asia. This really puts all of Central Asia, energy rich and energy poor, between a rock and a hard place. So I don't want to sound like the voice of doom here, but my prospects are great for Central Asia.
If it is indication of one thing, that's also that China is taking over, at least in financial terms, the Central Asia, which used to be a Russian backyard historically. And now I just want to give here some figures that I brought. When you look at the numbers, China is far bigger player than any other country in Kazakhstan, for example. For Kazakhstan, China makes up 21% of its total export, while Russia stands at 9% today. In Uzbekistan, share of China in its total export is 28%, while Russia is 19%. In Turkmenistan, I just said, China is the absolute major partner with 68% of share in its total export. Second to China is Turkey with only 5% of share. I just want to say some of these numbers belongs to 2014, but I'm sure the share of China has only increased since then. Now, China seems already a major player, and being one of the major export destination for Central Asia, how it's going to play out for especially stability of those regimes in the region? When China time to time play with the value of its currency, and it historically known as a country which keeps the value of its currency low.
Well, I've been following most closely Turkmenistan, so my observation would be sort of focusing on that. But you can use that, of course, it's an extreme case, but it's a sort of acid test for the whole region. So this year, you're right, the data you just mentioned show that the dependency of Turkmenistan on China is massive. I think in 2014, it just increased even more, because purchase of gas from Gazprom inevitably decreased, and the fact that Iran is now opening. I mean, we saw last week gas swaps between Kazakhstan and Iran, so obviously it's enlarging its horizon, which will eventually bring to the interruption of the oil flow, the two smallish pipeline in. Sort of which links Iran and Turkmenistan. So the prospect for Turkmenistan, it's 100% dependency in the longer term on China's purchases. Now, you don't want to be dependent on one single customer, but you don't want to be dependent on a single customer who's in trouble.
Yeah,
which is even a worse scenario, because that will slow down payment. It is also at a lower level, and. For what I hear in Turkmenistan, a lot of the construction is done by Chinese firms at the moment, which will slow down an even further part of the economy. Just to conclude, that the substantive failure of that kind of model of economic development in Turkmenistan is already eroding the stability of the regime. I heard that people are unhappy with the way in which Bedi Muhammadov has been running the state. Mm. Bedi Muhammadov does not have the same aura, if you want, clout than he used to be, so it's more prone to criticism. And most of it comes with the fact that the population is actually struggling. The perfect example is worker strikes in Lebap Belayat. Mm. Unheard of, but happened, and as a signal that something is profoundly wrong within Turkmenistan at the moment. And it also to do with China's slowdown.
Right.
I just wanted to add one thing to what Luca was saying, too, is, you know, not only is China becoming rapidly the sole partner of Turkmenistan, certainly as far as Turkmenistan's gas exports, but we have to remember that the original deals that were cut with the Chinese, we don't know exactly what China was paying for 1,000 cubic meters of Turkmen gas. Best estimates are somewhere around $195 or $200 per 1,000 cubic meters.
Yeah.
Now, as oil slides down and the price of gas slides down a bunch too, oil's dropped almost 70%, or it's going to be pretty soon 70%. Now, one of these days, China, especially as the sole customer, is going to come to Turkmenistan and say, we're not paying $195 per 1,000 cubic meters because that's way over the market value. So we want you to cut the price to $100, which makes it even worse for Turkmenistan because, of course, they're still paying back loans for pipeline construction and all that stuff, which Luca mentioned. So.
Exactly. So they are not reaping any benefits at the moment. And the money that they would like to get back will be sort of delayed over time because the price is halved. So the first profit that we will see from the Turkmenistan-China pipeline would be now happening in double the time expected, as with a gas price halved. So this is not a good prospect. I mean, this is probably the moment in which the failure of the political models in the region has brought up the failure of the economic models as well. So, I mean, again, I don't want to sound terribly pessimistic, but I can't see any good way out of this.
Right. This is not a good prospect. We spoke about Turkmenistan and Kazakhstan to an extent, but there is a country in between them, Kyrgyzstan. I think it's in many cases it's more vulnerable. I just want to give you a number here. In 2013, the share of Kazakhstan, Russia, in China altogether, remember, all of these countries are in trouble today. Share of these three countries in Kyrgyzstan's total export stands at nearly 50%. What does it mean to Kyrgyzstan? It's already known as one of the less stable countries in Central Asia. Who wants to take this question?
Well, I suppose I could at least start the ball rolling here. You know, the strange thing is, this is a harsh statement to make, but in the case of Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan, they've always been the poorer states in the region. And therefore, it's going to hurt them, but it won't hurt them what's happening to the same extent that it's going to hurt Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, and a little bit less so Uzbekistan. Yes, there will be problems in Kyrgyzstan, but then they've never had it. Things were never going so well to begin with, and all the time they've been independent. And you can make the same statement about Tajikistan. So it might be a little bit rougher of a patch than what they've been used to for a long time, but it won't be as noticeable as what Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan are about to witness. And again, to some extent, Uzbekistan is about to have a similar problem, too. So I would, you know, Kyrgyzstan, certainly there's going to be less Chinese investment in the long term. That's where they're going to lose a lot, because the Chinese, you know, I've already heard the people, the analysts explaining what China's policy are going to be. There's strategic projects that the Chinese are never going to give up. The oil pipelines, the gas pipelines, all that stuff, it's still going through. That's for sure. Now, roads for trade with Kyrgyzstan, probably not. The railway lines that they've been planning that would hook up, you know, Turkmenistan through Afghanistan and Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan, probably on the back burner already at this point. So those kind of projects, which would have helped Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan with trade, are probably very low priority for Beijing right now. Whereas the oil and gas pipelines, you know, the Chinese are always thinking strategically far, far into the future. That won't be given up. Possible improvements, extra lines, I could see them even doing that. But like I said, the railway network is one that just sticks out to me as something that's probably not, is going to be very delayed now.
Interesting, Bruce. I just wanted to put a counter argument to Bruce here. Bruce, you say that it is not going to hurt these minor countries compared to those oil producing or energy exporting countries to China. I mean, it will be less harmful. And then there is also another proverb. Let me put it in this way: proverb that we have, China being a central bank of Central Asia. And in that sense, these two poor countries is going to be the ones most affected from this situation. Again, I want to base my argument with some numbers here. Chinese state banks accounted for 42% of Tajikistan's approximately $2.1 billion external debt as of end of last year. In Kyrgyzstan, outstanding loans from China total over $1 billion, which is almost a third of the country's foreign dues. So what is going to happen? Chinese rule as a central bank of Central Asia going forward? Who wants to take this question?
Well, if I may jump in, China is certainly a major player, especially, as you mentioned, for the debt of these countries. But still, in real economic terms, remittances are the most important issues for income in these two countries. And to say in Kyrgyzstan, we have the new addition that we shouldn't overlook of being a member of the Eurasian Economic Union, which has not actually, apparently from the first report, has not taken away all the trade barriers that exist prior to that, to the accession. And so I think that the economic structure of Kyrgyzstan is going to still be very dependent on both remittances and still have the pending problem of the debt in with China. The most important thing for Kyrgyzstan's survival is how they're going to deal with the Kumtor gold mine, because that's actually their most important asset that brings back foreign currency. And there's been very many flip flops about this in the past few months from the government, from the parliament, and so there is tension in that respect. And I think with low commodity prices and with gold prices, especially, it's going to be tough for them.
Can I lean back to what Bruce was saying?
Yeah.
Just for a minute. I totally agree, and that's why I think that probably the biggest problem in this crisis is Kazakhstan, because this crisis actually shown that the aspirational model that the population was offered by the government, you know, the nouveau jour, we're going to get out of this crisis by spending, is actually not happening. So all those aspirations of wealth, of middle class emergence in Central in Kazakhstan are going to be crushed. I mean, we've been going there pretty much every year. I mean, Paolo and I, and I'm sure you guys as well, we knew that they were talking with people in Kazakhstan. There was, especially in urban areas, I mean, there was this sense that this country was going forward and everything was onward and upwards. I think that with all low oil prices and a tenge, which now is worth 25% less than it was a couple of weeks ago, these sort of dreams are gonna crash, and this could erode a significant part of the support in Nazarbayev, despite of all these authoritarian matters, had nevertheless within the country. And that's something which, for a aging regime with a complex elite, is not a positive development.
Dr. Luka, thank you very much for this insight. So going forward, what should change? And change immediately in the region in the light of what's happening today? Who wants to take this question? Briefly, please.
I'll be very quick. I think that the oil export, the energy-rich countries should really try to diversify as quickly as they can. The capital that Turkmenistan is putting into all the products you mentioned before, so sports and ports, should be very quickly diverted onto something that creates a no energy-related economy. And Kazakhstan should do this. I mean, it's a bigger economy, so it will take longer. But the quicker they get out of dependency on resources, the better it is for them.
Right.
You know, I'm going to second that, too, that I think that you know, you hate to say that this is going to be a blessing, but all these countries have been urged to diversify their economies for years and years, and this might be just a kick that they need to start doing something more practical toward reaching that goal, because you know, they were living on this, you know, it was this party that was going on where, you know, hydrocarbons were going up, and like I said, they seemed to get the idea it was never going to stop. I mean, just a couple of years ago, people were saying oil might hit $200 a barrel. Now they're saying it might hit 20. You know, so it's been a sobering experience for them, but hopefully they'll learn something from this and try to find other areas of industry within their countries that they can improve and develop so that they're not so dependent on these energy exports for their revenue.
Paolo?
One thing. Paolo, just to finish up what Bruce was saying, also because in the 90s the government was saying, well, we are dependent because that was the Soviet way of doing things. In the 2000s, no one cared because the oil price, it was high. But now we only got the regime to blame, and that's something which is troublesome in the relationship between polity and regime.
Paolo?
I agree with you guys, but I think that putting the entire weight of this crisis on the population by devaluing the currency was a strictly wrong move from the government. And so I think they're going to, as Luka said, they're going to suffer in terms of approval rates and both official and unofficial approval rates. Because the structure of changes in an economy, I don't think can be done through just devaluing the currency and slashing the government salaries and denting the profits of the government-owned companies. And so I think that the issue, that they already made a mistake in this case, and I think that, that this mistake will have a, an impact. And I don't really think that it's reversible in the short and medium term.
It certainly undercuts our credibility, considering how many officials have said again and again, no current, no second devaluation.
Exactly.
It's a long debate. Thank you very much for sharing your thoughts, Dr. Luca Ancesci from University of Glasgow, Paolo Cerbello from Italy, and Bruce Panier, my colleague here in the studio. Thank you very much for your insights on this important subject. Dear listeners, thank you very much for your time for listening to the podcast. We always welcome your thoughts on opinions expressed in the program as well as topic we discussed today. You can reach us via rferl.org. You can also post your comments via facebook.com/rferl. You can also follow us on twitter.com/rferl. From me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the show, and all of the team here in Prague, thank you very much for being with us. Bye-bye.